How do cancer outcomes in New Zealand compare to Australia? How can we optimise post-neoadjuvant treatment in patients with early breast cancer who achieve pathologic complete response? Does bevacizumab improve efficacy when administered with platinum combination therapy and atezolizumab in patients with advanced non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer? And how do AI chatbots perform when asked for cancer treatment recommendations? Welcome to the Oncology Journal Club podcast, your go-to source for in-depth discussions on the latest oncology research tailored for medical professionals. I'm your producer, Rachel Babin, from the Oncology Podcast. I'm joined by our esteemed hosts, Professor Craig Underhill, Dr. Kate Clark, and Professor Christopher Jackson. For additional insights, links, and comprehensive bios of all of our hosts, visit the show notes on oncologynetwork.com.au. Produced with pride by the podcast team at the Oncology Network, we invite you to join us as we delve into the intricacies of oncology research and its clinical applications.
Kia ora, g'day, kia ora. Welcome back, everybody, to the Oncology Journal Club podcast. Great to be here with Kate Clark and Professor Chris Jackson from New Zealand. We have some exciting papers to discuss today. We'll each do a long paper and then some quick papers. People can then delve into some detail on via the links on the webpage. Thanks for all the feedback to date to everybody. It's been some great feedback. We love hearing from you all. And please let us know about anything you think could be improved, or if you have any suggestions for papers, please send them in. And you might even score a chair at this mixing desk and be interviewed about a paper if you wish. So without any further ado, we'll get straight into it. And I think Professor Chris Jackson has the first paper, which is a little bit sad, a little bit of a reality check for all of us. So Chris, over to you.
Oh, kia ora, Craig. Great to be back on the show this week. Nice to see you again, also, Craig. You're on the road at the moment, is that right?
Yeah, on holidays, Chris. Oh, I'm actually in my leisure wear. None of the listeners need to conjure up the image into their brain, but I'm currently in a nice, loose, let's say, relaxed attire.
A good oncologist can create a verbal picture with their words like a radiologist or a pathologist, perhaps. So let's see how we go. The show host is dressed in mid-grey with an elasticated hoodie. The white Apple AirPods drapes from his ears. He has a dishevelled look as if he's been concerned and sweating over his papers over many hours. He looks intelligently into the screen as he considers the data. Professor Cray, what will he come up with next?
What it's going to do is going to prod you to get going on your discussion.
We're giving Rachel lots to get in and out to listen up. Well, this week's contribution is from the mighty New Zealand Medical Journal. And instead of doing a original article this week, I'm going to cover an editorial which came out and has garnered a lot of attention here in New Zealand. And that's looking at the cancer stats, cancer outcomes in New Zealand and other countries. How are we doing? There's been a lot of talk over recent time about New Zealand's cancer outcomes because historically we've done a little bit worse than Australia. And there's a lot of chatter about why that might be. I think this editorial brings it to stark contrast, and it used a figure of something like 1,200 people would live if New Zealand had Australia's cancer survival rate, which is always going to get people's attention. And behind those numbers is quite a complicated story. So this editorial in the New Zealand Medical Journal by Professor Mark Elwood, Professor of Cancer Epidemiology, a world-renowned and respected epidemiologist, dived in as compared the outcomes over time for pre-cohort periods, and has compared the excess mortality and the five-year survival over these three time periods, and has looked at them by cancer and seen where the difference is. When we're talking about cancer epidemiology, we have to think about incidence, mortality, and survival, which of course are all related, but you can't just get one figure to get what's going on. There's not one easy way of summarizing the whole lot. Cancer incidence is largely driven by two things. One is your cancer risk factors, so smoking, alcohol, obesity, et cetera, et cetera. And then also your diagnosis. So, for example, prostate cancer incidence is high if you have a high rates of PSA testing, for example. Myeloma rates are high if you take off a lot of skin lesions. Myeloma rates in New Zealand went down during COVID because they took off fewer skin lesions. But then there are other cancers which are always going to turn up, like pancreas cancer. You can't overdiagnose that. Cancer mortality is a product of both your incidence, so how many cancers you get, and actually how many you cure. So your mortality is affected by those two things. And then relative survival, is a reflection of your success of treating the cancer. The five-year relative survival was influenced by stage of diagnosis. So if you diagnose earlier cancers, so more stage one cancers through overdiagnosis, say of early melanomas, then your five-year survival could look artificially better than it actually is. So when you're trying to understand how a country is doing, you have to consider incidence, mortality, and relative survival, because no one of those three actually tells you the whole picture. What this editorial summarizes is a mix of all of those three things over that time period. It found that a lot of the excess deaths in New Zealand were due to excess deaths in females, which has persisted over time between the two countries. The excess deaths between men in Australia and men in New Zealand isn't all that different. But within New Zealand, there's differences too, because our Indigenous population, New Zealand Māori, do a lot worse in terms of both cancer incidence and cancer mortality. The paper breaks it down. It looks at the excess deaths in lung, breast and colorectal in particular, and also uterine cancer. There are a few cancers where Australia has a higher incidence, and it's said that this is actually not a factor in the survival rates, but I would take a slightly different view. I think if you've got a higher incidence, it can reflect overdiagnosis or the pickup of incidental cancers, or otherwise not have caused that person's death. Over time, we've had a bunch of change of risk factors as well between the two countries. So smoking rates in New Zealand females are actually higher than in many other countries. That could drive an excess of incident lung cancers in particular. There's excess colon cancer deaths in New Zealand compared to Australia over that time. But actually, Australia was 5 to 8 years ahead on the implementation of the screening program. So you would expect Australia to have lower colon cancer-related deaths than New Zealand. But we are also picking up cancers at a later stage in New Zealand that much is irrefutable. It also coincides with another paper that's come out recently from the International Cancer Benchmarking Project and been rerun by our cancer agency here in New Zealand, which looks at the rate of emergency presentations of cancer. And New Zealand, unfortunately, has one of the highest rates of emergency presentation of cancer of comparable countries. More than 30% of all cancers are picked up via emergency presentation. Now, emergency presentation is defined as someone comes to an ED and their cancer is diagnosed within 30 days of that first emergency presentation. So it can be an inpatient admission or a result of that emergency presentation. That's higher for bowel cancer in New Zealand. That's higher for lung cancer in New Zealand as well. And that high rate of emergency presentation reflects probably a dysfunctional early diagnostic pathway that could be better. We have a higher rate of emergency presentation in New Zealand than in comparable countries. Now, you're never going to get a zero emergency presentation rate because we all know that people turn up with bowel obstruction for the first diagnosis of their bowel cancer. But it's higher in New Zealand than other countries. And it probably reflects a relatively less well-developed diagnosis and referral pathway than, say, in Australia. New Zealand has, interestingly, 35% fewer CT scanners per head of population than Australia does, but a similar number of MRI scanners. We've certainly got poorer access to nuclear medicine than you do in Australia, and we've certainly got poorer access to luminal investigations such as endoscopy and colonoscopy than you do in Australia. And part of that is the funding mechanism, I suspect, between the two countries. When it comes to cure rates, we're doing okay on some things. For example, brain cancer, pancreas cancer, ovarian cancer, there's no difference in outcomes between the two countries. Melanoma, stomach and esophageal cancer, unfortunately, there's a persistent disparity between the countries. But for men, the outcomes for lung, esophageal cancer, brain cancer, and pancreatic cancer are actually slightly better than Australia. So it's a complicated picture between all of those. There will be some therapeutic differences. So Australia has better access to cancer drugs, but mostly that's in the palliative space rather than the curative setting. So the drugs aren't the entire answer either. And also, most of those palliative drugs might improve your one-year relative survival, but shouldn't improve your five-year relative survival. So what do I take away from this editorial? I take away from this editorial that we do have a higher rate of excess deaths than Australia when it comes to cancer. Some of that is driven by differences in incidence, which in particular is female lung cancer. Some of it is due to differences in screening practices, such as diagnosis of early breast cancer and melanoma. Some of it will be due to probably better access to therapeutic services, particularly early investigation with scanning and access to early investigations. Having said all of that, Australia is one of the best countries in the world routinely when it comes to cancer survival and lower rates of cancer mortality than many other comparable countries. And I think we have to have an open mind as to why that is. And I'd be interested in any listeners' comments or thoughts or reflections on things that Australia does particularly well, and thoughts from Craig on what you think Aussie's doing, which is world-leading.
It's interesting to postulate why some of those differences are. I've picked up, Chris, in the paper that there was a lower incidence of cancer in New Zealand, which might just reflect that you're not picking up cancers as well at an early stage. But clearly there's some differences in access to drugs, as you say, in the palliative setting. But given that we see now with immunotherapy such long-term survivals in significant subgroups of patients, I'm sure going forward, in the next set of, this is 2006, 2010, but I would have thought in later sets of data, we'll see potentially bigger differences. I like to bring it down to the sort of human level. So you're talking about a 4% difference between New Zealand and Australia, 5-year survival, 10,000 annual deaths in New Zealand 2008. So that's 4%, 10,000 is 400 people. So it's 400 extra deaths, 400 extra families and sets of families and friends. It's quite stark when you translate it into those kind of numbers. And it's a similar kind of difference between, we see between regional Australia, metropolitan Australia in the state of Victoria, that there's about 10,000 cancer cases diagnosed. Regionally, to a 4% difference is about 400 people. When you put it in those terms, it's quite substantial. It's way more than the road toll, and billions of dollars is invested in fences along highways and promos on telly and all the rest of it.
That's exactly where I was going to go, Craig, which is that we value deaths by accident. And value is probably the wrong word, but we put a monetary value on deaths by accident. Mm-hmm. It's much higher than deaths by illness. And the justification for billion-dollar highways is often one or two deaths, but we can't spend $100 per person on having easy GP access. We're going to have a health target shortly in New Zealand, which is from decision to treat to treatment, but that's not where there are gaps. But that's our gap is before that. So you're cheating by having a target that we know we can meet and not fixing the real problem, which is symptoms to diagnosis and then diagnosis to get in front of somebody who can actually help you. So, I despair. I don't really understand why it's okay to build billion-dollar highways and it's not okay to spend millions on healthcare. But part of me wonders whether there genuinely are people in positions of decision-making who think they are immune to illness but maybe not immune to road accidents.
Yeah, I guess it shows that we need this information and we need to translate that into digestible information that we can use to advocate for more resources across the cancer control system to try and address it.
Yeah, the cancer control continuum, when you're looking at cancer control from a systems perspective, clearly you get a lot of gains from prevention, but which again, it was sad to see the New Zealand government dismantling the world-leading smoke-free laws, for example, and that will ricochet for generations in terms of the number of people who will die as a result of that. It's madness. But also our inability to regulate the food environment and the persistence of easy advertising to kids, for example, and the normalisation of alcohol around schools, for example, as well, advertising and liquor store outlets around schools. So there are certainly things you can do from a political and structural perspective when it looks at your cancer risk factors without unnecessarily limiting adult freedoms, because I accept there's a trade-off between nanny state and freedom of choice, et cetera. But we can't ignore the capitalist pressures of marketing, which actually are carcinogenic by promoting consumption of products which are poor for your health.
And just while I'm on my transport bugbear, we are not continuing to encourage active transport. Even walking to the bus is frowned on. We put everybody in cars, everybody in a car. Even if you talk about pollution, the pollution inside a car is significantly worse than the pollution for those people who are riding past the car. And we don't know what those microparticulates are doing to people, but we're quite comfortable putting people in that environment time and time again for hours of their day. And that's not normal, and it's not what we were designed to, how we were designed to live.
I really agree with that, Kate. I think you look at New Zealand's third on the International Obesity Index scale as well, and so I think we have to double down on active transport. as well. I agree with that. And also there's some great work done by Charlie Swanton and his group, which looked at the incidence of lung cancer in relation to air pollution, particularly in the UK. And that I think is demonstrating the link between air pollution and lung cancer, and probably explains a large number of those 50% of cases of lung, which are not related to smoking, for example. So I think we'll see more of that in the future too. So air quality, air pollution are certainly going to be factors in carcinogenesis too.
Great. Chris refers to the editorial in his discussion. We'll also put a link to the original paper that the editorial was talking about. People want to dive into more detail. Kate, what have you got for us this episode?
So my long paper won't be as long as Chris, but I just wanted to draw people's attention. I despair, I think, perhaps at the inequities between disease types, even in the way that we think about things. So for the uninitiated, those patients that gain a pathological complete response after systemic therapy in breast cancer, before resection of their breast and whatever axillary staging you're doing, do beautifully well. Doesn't matter how you get there, whether it's 3 days of chemotherapy or 6 months of chemo with Pembro. If you are lucky enough, quote unquote, to get to a pathological complete response, your event-free survival across almost all trials is 95-96%. Many of our new trials mandate therapy after the surgery as well, regardless of PCR. Some of those therapies obviously are toxic. Many of them are financially toxic. And if that's in the trial and there's nowhere a pathological complete response, a patient who attains a pathological complete response has a de-escalated regimen, then we are stuck retrospectively doing de-intensification non-inferiority trials, which will never prove that a lesser standard is safe. So this is just an editorial talking about how we could do that and where we've got to, and I think it's very interesting. But the inequity is that in 95% event-free survival in any other disease type that I treated, I would be delighted, and I would not be despairing about the fact that there are some, and sorry, that's a 95% invasive disease-free survival, which in breast cancer means that new breast cancers, it was the crap out of me. You know, maybe not even an endpoint that's relevant for an adjuvant curative trial. So that's my little rant. We really need to start planning trials rather than doing trials and then going, whoops, we've just mandated 9 months of therapy that may or may not be necessary to 65% of our women.
Paper, Kate. And I think in the context of that discussion about improving cancer survival in New Zealand and in Australia, I think clinical trials are an important issue, aren't they? Because I think that's one way that we drive new knowledge, but also an individual patient. We see people who do better than expected often on the clinical trials. I like the discussion in the paper, they use the word optimization of treatment rather than de-escalation, which has this negative connotation. Doesn't matter that you're reducing the treatment, but it's really about optimizing the treatment and not exposing the people to treatment they don't need.
Yeah, I think particularly when you're talking about immunotherapy, where you do get late surprise toxicities, some of which are devastating, but some of them, even though they may only be annoying, might be a tablet for the rest of your life. And some of these women are in their 30s and 40s.
All right. I'm going to talk about lung cancer and also black humour warning in the context of our recent discussion about outcomes in New Zealand and the tearing down of the anti-smoking laws. I thought it might be important for the Kiwis listening to and Chris and Kate to learn a bit more about lung cancer. So this was a randomised clinical trial comparing atezolizumab, and platinum plus pemetrexed with or without bevacizumab, patients with metastatic non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer, a randomized clinical trial in JAMA Oncology in March. The atezo, platinum, pemetrexed, bevacizumab regimen, this four-drug regimen, has been the standard of care for some time. And the questions was shown in a randomized trial to be effective. But it's been often discussed, do we really need the bevacizumab? This was a paper done in Japan. So first potential criticism of this paper has been done in a predominantly Asian population in Japan. This was a study done at 37 hospitals across Japan. And so patients with advanced non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer without driver alterations of the gene were randomized to receive pemetrexed, carboplatin, atezo, and bev, or the same combination without the bevacizumab. So after four induction cycles of the four drugs, they then went on to maintenance atezo and pemetrexed. with or without the bevacizumab and went on for 2 years. So the primary endpoint was a progression-free survival as assessed by blinded independent central review and the intention to treat population. There was 400 patients, so the study was fairly well powered, and they actually showed, in essence, the blinded independently assessed progression-free survival was 9.6 months versus in the combination versus 7.7 in the arm without the bevacizumab, which was not statistically significant difference. They did do a specific subgroup analysis in patients with oncogene positive patients, and these were predominantly patients with EGFR mutations. And interestingly, that did show a bigger difference, 9.7 months versus 5.8 months. So this was pre-planned subgroup analysis, but it's really hypothesis generating. And the authors postulated that bevacizumab mechanism of action may be delivering drug better to the local environment, which has been the sort of postulated mechanism of action of bevacizumab for some time. So the toxic effects related to Bev were increased in the patients who received that. And basically the conclusion from this study was that the 4-drug combination did not show superiority over the 3-drug combination for non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer. But they noted that there was this hint of potential improved survival in the patients with driver oncogenes who were predominantly getting the drugs second line after having their targeted therapies first line. So an interesting paper. It probably hasn't answered the question definitively, but I think that it's safe to say that if there's any concern about possible relative contraindication to giving this drug in patients with lung cancer, that we could withhold the bevacizumab regimen. I think on the PBS in Australia, it mandates the 4, but there is a PBS indication for patients who are intolerant. So I think this move is now allowable under the current treatment restrictions in Australia. So I think people should be, my take-home message would be that people can be a bit circumspect on the need to use the bevacizumab, and if there's any doubt about whether it's just going to add toxicity, which can be significant, then probably that's the right way to go.
Do you see much hemorrhage or cavitation in lung cancer with use of bevacizumab, Craig?
Well, we see hemoptysis actually relatively infrequently, I think. And certainly in my practice, I don't seem to see it that often. But the bevacizumab, we've had patients, remember the first trial, might have been in lung cancer, but, you know, one of the first patients we enrolled on a randomized phase 3 study had a stroke and they were on the bevacizumab. So that was a concern. So it can be not just about bleeding, Chris, but, you know, there's got a life-threatening vascular complications. And in a population of people that are at risk of that, right?
Yeah, certainly. I remember one of my early days as a research registrar as well, looking at the oral VEGF agents and similar experience, Craig, causing someone to stroke out. And I think it's fair to say bevacizumab is one of the most overhyped and underdelivered drugs in the history of oncology. And I actually don't remember a trial with bevacizumab I've been impressed with, particularly because the gains are always very, very marginal, aren't they, with the use of the agent. I think I'd have to say it's one of the most weakly active drugs around, and that its impact on outcomes overall is very small. Not to say it's inactive. It's just very, very modestly active in most tumours.
Great. Let's move along now. We've all got a series of quick bites, short bites, call them what you like.
Well, my first quick bite is something, because we run this podcast at 5 till 6 when we record it, I get quite peckish. So I've brought my own quick bites today, and I'm having smoked provolone cheese with some Huntley and Palmer salt and cracked pepper biscuits. And I've got to say, it's quite delicious to be taken away on these. So that's my quick bite. I'm also interested in quick bites in the way in which oncologists and pathologists and radiologists always describe cancer in terms of food. Why is it that we're so obsessed with food? We heard someone today describing their rectal cancer as like a broccoli in the lumen of the bowel. And that created quite the mental picture, didn't it? So here's my quick bite. Mmm, cheesy deliciousness.
You invited him up to the show.
I think it was the other way around. I think he was here pre-existing. But the sad thing is the listeners at home don't get the image of him head down furrowing away towards the camera, which was quite intimidating.
Who sends your professorial status up for review?
I'm almost about to celebrate my 1 year since my inaugural professorial lecture, which is available on YouTube. Download now.
Before we delve deeper into today's episode, we want to thank you for your continued support. If you're a healthcare professional who shares our passion for these insightful discussions, we invite you to join our community at oncologynetwork.com.au. Registration is free and includes a complimentary subscription to our weekly publication, The Oncology Newsletter, and regular podcast updates. But that's not all. Your voice matters to us. We value your input and welcome your feedback and paper recommendations. Together, we can shape the conversation and drive the direction of future episodes. Visit oncologynetwork.com.au today and join us in our mission to advance the field of oncology through collaboration, knowledge sharing, and innovation. And now, hopefully, CJ has finished his snack and we can get stuck into his quick bites.
Right. Well, I've got the study called the DTORCH study, which was presented at ESCO last year, but just published last month in the JCO. And this is one of my favorite studies from all of last year, and it's so good to see it in print. And the DTORCH study is a randomized controlled, double-blind, investigator-initiated study of diclofenac hand gel in patients treated with capecitabine. Now, the DTORCH study has an Australian connection because the protocol was actually worked up at the Accord workshop under the watchful eye of Martin Stockler and co. And the Accord team get a shout out and the thank yous at the end of the paper too, which is a really nice connection there. Anyway, it's a single center study undertaken in India of topical diclofenac, 1%, 1 gram to each hand twice a day, when you defeat just the hands. And a gram was one finger daub worth on each side of the hand rubbed in twice a day. 30 gram tubes, that's pretty much going to be about 12 to 16 tubes over the course of a 12 week course. They gave 12 weeks worth of the gel. The primary endpoint was grade 2 or 3 hand foot syndrome, which everyone will know. Grade 2 and 3 hand foot syndrome is clinically meaningful and distressing to patients. The beauty of the study was it showed that 12 weeks use of diclofenac gel, 1 gram twice a day, both hands, reduced the incidence of grade 2, 3 hand foot syndrome significantly. Grade 2 hand foot syndrome went from 9.8 to 1.5%, and grade 3 went from 5.3 to 2.3%, and that's highly statistically significant. The number needed to treat is around about 10, which is pretty good. Importantly, we saw, the investigators saw, fewer dose reductions in people who were treated with prophylactic diclofenac, with 41 patients having dose reduction in the placebo arm and 21 patients in the diclofenac arm. Importantly, there was no excess toxicity of other types as a result. So if you have reduced dose reductions because you've got less hand foot syndrome, the chances you're having more pills, so you're more at risk of having GI toxicity, for example. But they didn't see that. There was no additional excess toxicity in other organs, which I think was very, very reassuring. So I thought that was a really lovely study. It's practice changing immediately in our neck of the woods, and we are recommending people use the diclofenac hand gel. So that is available at the Chemist Warehouse for about $20 a tube, which unfortunately is not yet subsidised. But all of us here in New Zealand are quite keen to write to PharmEd and see if they'll fund that alongside the treatment, because it should hopefully lead to long-term better outcomes of cancer by better dose intensity.
Great. Good paper. We've started doing the same thing, Chris. So, eight?
We're a proponent here for women on, you know, palliative capecitabine, particularly for breast cancer, of the 1.5 gram BD 7 days on, 7 days off regimen, which is very tolerable. I don't think we've got our cape doses right yet. I don't think we've got our doses. I don't think we've got our schedule right. I think maximum tolerated dose for 2 weeks, if you can get through and then recover and then start again if you're back to grade one, is not right. I use a diclofenac gel, or I ask my patients to use a diclofenac gel as well, but I applaud any investigators who continue to try and finesse what is a really good drug if you can get it into people, but finesse our understanding of what the right regimen is, because I don't think we know yet.
Yeah, good point, Kate. You got a couple of quick papers for us?
Yeah, look, just a couple of papers, mostly for the Kiwis. I don't know, who treats liver cancer in Australia?
Well, some of the upper GI medical oncologists, GI medical oncologists. Is this probably, you know, and maybe one of those because it's relatively rare that's seen in a number of different units at low volumes?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's that rare, my friend. So we've just had a trial open for, in our tin pot little city, for a matter of weeks and filled our four slots.
Oh, wow.
Screen date, senior four slots. So, you know, it's not rare. I just don't think medocs are seeing it. I think we haven't got our pathway sorted.
Yeah, that might be the case, Kate. That's a good point.
And I know a lot of gastroenterologists are treating it. But these are drugs with sometimes earth-shattering toxicity. And so I think this is something we're going to have to be moving into that space. And if we ever get funding, that would be great. But so the two papers are the ASCO guidelines, which I think are very clear and acknowledge the fact that you're treating two diseases, because it's very unusual for somebody to get a hepatocellular carcinoma who doesn't also have an unwell liver. And so you've got two competing diseases. It's also an unusual place in that probably one of the only cancers, perhaps except for diffuse gastric cancer, where the person keeps developing new cancers because the driver for the cancer is sitting there still chugging away. So it's fascinating. And then the other paper is the four-year outcomes from STRIDE, which is the beautifully designed in terms of those of us who are budget conscious, one dose of an anti-CTLA-4 and then low dose anti-PD-1, no further doses of anti-CTLA-4. And the four-year OS is 25%, which is, you know, stonking. If you respond at all, your four-year survival is more like 50%, which is really useful information for patients. So I like these two papers for those of us who are in the niche but increasingly busy medical oncology practice that look after liver cancer patients. They are also some of the most interesting people, because all sorts of people end up with hepatocellular carcinoma. So my clinics are full of some really, really interesting, great storytellers, which is always fun.
Yeah, in our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population, 2K HCC is overrepresented as one of the more common cancers. So we've been doing some work in that space to try and improve access to clinical trials in our large MRFF-funded grant. And one of the things is to try and match cancers and the types of trials you have. So we're now trying to effectively have trials open for HCC so that if we do see an Aboriginal patient with hepatocellular carcinoma, we do have a potential clinical trial available to give them access to latest regimens, which, you know, on the funding system tend to lag behind real world by a few years. So in the guidelines paper, Kate, what is the standard first line treatment now? Is it the immunotherapy or is it immunotherapy and a targeted therapy?
No, so the two standard regimens, because there's not been head-to-head comparison, mm-hmm. are either, and I struggle so hard to say these, so STRIDE regimen, which was from the Himalaya paper, or the atezo-bevacizumab and BRAVE paper. And I'm fascinated by, in lung cancer, the thought is the bevacizumab isn't particularly helpful except in X, Y, and Z, and then we retrospectively find a justification. The thought in liver cancer is you've got an exhausted immune system, and the bevacizumab acts to wake that up. Again, fascinating that we even look at the drugs differently depending on who we're putting them into rather than having a thing. Anyway, those are the standard first regimens for whom there isn't a contraindication. And then your TKIs are either second line or that's what you reach to for those patients who have a contraindication.
Kate, the MBRAVE study, I know it's subgroup analysis stuff, but the origin of the liver disease seemed to be important in terms of your outcomes in that one, right? So the Hep B patients, for example, responded much better than the non-viral origin patients. Is that correct?
It is correct. And it would be my clinical experience too of about 10 patients. So, you know, naughty anecdote.
Exhaustive. Yeah, exhausting. So.
Yeah, yeah. I think one of the complicating factors, though, is that there is, in New Zealand and in most of the world, there is often an ethnic difference right down the line of those two things. And the way that many of the trials define patients' ethnicity means that the data that they can get out of that is very... So we are Asian on occasion. We are rest of world on occasion in terms of where we are. Our patients are white, black, or other, which means that you're not actually getting... I suspect that, yeah, some of it is about viral hepatitis and subsequent cirrhosis. Some of it is about the person themselves. So I suspect there's more going in pharmacogenomics. I suspect there's more going on there than we are going to tease out from that. In New Zealand, the vast majority of people I see with cirrhosis, with HCC are viral related, sadly. We've had a vaccine in this country since the 80s and still seeing it in young people. But you do see people with alcoholic histories, or more concerning for Joe Blogs in the street, whatever we're calling non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, is their probable progenitor problem.
Yeah, I think there's been eradication programs of Hep B in prisons, for example, which have been quite successful down this part of the world. So We expect in our part of the world for the viral hepatitis to be a sunset disease, hopefully. We're seeing a lot more of the metabolic type hepatomas, which I think are certainly growing with the demographic shift as well. Interesting though, in the Himalaya study there in the forest plots, it didn't really seem to be a viral versus non-viral origin, but the Hep B's and C's did quite differently according to the regime there as well. So I think there's still a lot more to be teased out in terms of origin of liver disease and the efficacy of these agents and the approach we're supposed to take.
Yeah. I just would, and I realize it's a lot of work being done in the hepatitis B space and hepatitis C space, but really we can't go to sleep on those. We routinely screen, and I'm sure everybody does, and looking after the patients that I do, there is a lot of silent hepatitis out there that we, hepatitis B out there particularly, that we have not been picking up in any other way. And somebody will come to me in their 50s with the transaminitis and hepatitis B that I find out incidentally to their breast cancer.
Okay. Thank you. So we're big fans of publicizing guidelines on the OGC. So Kate, that was an interesting guideline on HCC, and I put up two concurrent publications from ASCO guidelines for stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer, both with driver alterations in a separate paper. Without, the first author was Ishmael Jayashimi and senior author Jayoti Patel. So it's a group of experts set up by ASCO, includes some people known to the podcast, including Natasha Leal and Balash Helmos. G'day, Natasha and Balash. And these are really good guidelines. The one without driver alterations dated previous one by addition of 10 new randomized clinical trials. So they go through all of the detail, but there's some really great tables in the paper, which are basically flowcharts of how you might manage patients. So I urge any of you who are looking after people with lung cancer to have a look at those tables, and they grade the treatment regimens according to strong or weak. So there's multiple regimens available, for example, in a patient with non-squamous lung cancer with a PD-L expression that's high. There's a total of 9 listed there, but 3 are given a strong recommendation. So a good paper. And then in the realm of patients with driver mutations, again, it goes through the detail of the randomized controlled trials published to date, and also summarized it in some excellent flow diagrams. So I'd urge anyone interested in lung cancer to have a look at that. And then my other two papers were a little bit more provocative, let's say. The first one is a letter to the editor in JAMA Oncology, the use of artificial intelligence chatbots for cancer treatment information. We don't have time to go through this in detail, but it basically matched the ChatGPT chatbot's recommendations versus the NCCN guidelines. Interestingly, 12% of the outputs were hallucinated. So the chatbot came up with a treatment recommendation that wasn't even contained in the guidelines. And in 1/3 of recommendations, they were non-concordant with the current guidelines. So it was a bit of a caution check for some people, including oncologists who've leapt onto ChatGPT. ChatGPT has these language learning models have been shown in other papers to pass the US medical licensing exam, encode clinical knowledge and provide diagnoses better than lay people. But what they don't do in this paper is clearly in an individual patient come up with correct recommendations in 1/3 of the cases. So that was a very interesting paper. It was done at a point in time with the current model of ChatGPT, and obviously that's evolving, but and things will improve. But for now, interesting information.
Craig, what was the last question that you asked ChatGPT?
I don't use ChatGPT, Chris, because I've been getting some letters from people clearly generated by ChatGPT, and they are garbage. So instead of
lots of like birthday cards from your wife, that sort of thing.
No, some letters from colleagues, instead of saying, no, dear Craig, it would be like, dearly beloved, I wish to see that you are well at this time, time space continuum, and couldn't you please let me know? Like, it's like florally language that's clearly stuff that people don't say. And so I think I have quite a radar for ChatGPT generated stuff. And to me, it's getting there, but it's not quite there yet.
Maybe next time we'll stop in a ChatGPT developed
script
OGC paper, and we'll see if anyone can pick up the difference between the real paper and the ChatGPT developed paper.
So are you a fan, Chris?
I think one of the things that AGITG circles may have come across with Dr. Jackson in years gone by is my love of medical comedy rock songs, and how I certainly have a penchant for those. And I've certainly got ChatGPT to try and write me a few comedy rock songs in recent times, and they do quite a good job of writing lyrics according to a genre of a particular artist.
Yeah, that's cool.
I'll see if I can get ChatGPT to write you a song by the end of this podcast.
Yeah, that's good. Great. That could be our outro. And the last one's a bit of a serious paper, Financial Conflicts of Interest Payment at the Expense of Patients, editorial done by Nina Sanford and Vishal Gawali. Big shout out to Vishal, who's, of course, one of the leaders in the common sense oncology space. Chris, but this was based on a paper out of the Netherlands conducted between 2019 and 2021. And they found that 48% of oncologists received payments from drug companies, various bits of work. And interestingly, that was concentrated in the key opinion leaders. So 47% of the total sum went to just 20 oncologists, or 1% of the clinical population. It was similar to the previous finding in the US, where 37% of total general payments in a year went to 1% of oncologists. And so being conflicted in it's not a problem per se, unless it's not disclosed, and it may become a problem if these people who are receiving the high levels of payments are also sitting on advisory boards for government or writing guidelines. So what this editorial suggests is that disclosure is one step and not sufficient. And they recommended that physicians sitting on national guideline committees, such as the NCCN in US or the CIEDO in Netherlands, should not receive any general payments from pharmaceutical companies during the time they're active committee members. Secondly, professional societies should also that mandate that members serving in their leadership do not receive any general payments. That's ASCO's current policy. And they argued that this policy should also include not just the president and leadership members, but also the annual meeting presidents, the educational track leads and discussants at major meetings. I think that would be good move. Principal investigators and co-investigators of clinical trials should not be permitted to hold stock for the drug or product while it is under study. And fourthly, editorialists should not have financial conflicts of interest with the same company whose drug or product is under discussion. This was previously the policy at New England Journal until 2002, and some other leading journals such as B&J have since 2014 restricted editorials and educational authors to those without financial conflicts of interest. And they recommend that this policy should be implemented and monitored. So it's interesting, when I give a talk, occasionally asked to give a talk and it's a company sponsored event, I will put up a slide with disclosures, and it's often most of the funding, not 90% of the time, it's funding that's going to the department, but I still declare that we're doing trials with these companies. And so my department's received the funding, but you know, occasionally I'll be on an advisory board, not very often. Occasionally we'll accept payment for educational weekend somewhere. But I think it's really important to disclose it. And I think these recommendations going further, that you should also come off any public appointments where that financial conflict could have an influence. So interesting paper. Eight, looking pensive.
I don't at all disagree that conflict of interest needs to be declared. And I don't at all disagree that people in positions of power have the potential to be influenced and need to be open and aware of those concerns. I just worry, in a little community like ours, that you would very quickly not have a lot of people available to do those public jobs if anybody who had ever spent some time having a cup of coffee with a drug rep would have to recuse themselves. And I think I'm not accepting luxury weekend holidays in Hawaii, but I'm just not quite sure. not quite sure how to put my finger on it. That's my pensiveness. I think it's complex. I think in a place this small where those type of roles are all unpaid, that you'll have fewer and fewer people wanting to do them.
Yeah. I think it's important that at least we're all mindful of those potential conflicts of interest. And if I was in a major public position in New Zealand giving running guidelines, I probably wouldn't have a cup of tea with the drug company.
Yeah. I think the thing that I giggle is that when you sign up to be a PI or a sub-I, you have to say you have less than $50,000 US stock. And I always giggle because, you know, that's a lot of stock in one company. You have to be seriously wealthy. So I wonder whether some of our thresholds for declaration are very, very soft.
Yes.
And maybe need some tightening up. And actually, maybe buying stock, you know, that's possibly cheap while you're running the study, but that might not be when you're making all the money anyway. So again, I think maybe these guidelines need some thought. So I'm not saying they don't need thought. I'm just thinking that maybe they need some thought. And we push for many of the publicly guidelined kind of assistance is unpaid. And the quid pro quo was always that would somehow come out of space in your clinical work, but it doesn't. And so the same people are doing a lot of work after hours. So
yeah.
So congratulations to those people, if anybody's listening in.
I think there's some good suggestions in this paper. Chris, final word?
I don't think I've got anything particularly wise to add. I think that financial conflicts of interest do have a potentially corrosive effect, particularly of people who have positions of influence over regulatory decisions and funding decisions. So I think that is an area where you can't have any financial COIs at all. But also think people who've got public advocacy roles, who have got strong financial conflicts of interest, need to have those able to be disclosed because they can influence the public discourse in a very negative way. So I think the disclosure, full and free disclosure, putting sunlight on it, as is done in both Australia and New Zealand, declaring all financial COIs in the public researchable database is very important for that.
Okay.
And ChatGPT has come up with the goods for us. Now, what our OJC listeners won't be aware is that Professor Craig is currently about to run a marathon.
Half marathon.
So I've asked ChatGPT to come up with a song about our erstwhile running oncologist. In the style of Taylor Swift. So you're going to have to imagine me singing like Tater. In a world that's often grey and cold, there's a story that's seldom told of a man who wears two kinds of shoes, one for healing and one for the truths. He's a hero in the wars of white, fighting battles through the day and night, with a heart as vast as the southern sea. Craig's the name that whispers, believe in me. From the shores of Sydney's sunlit bays to the Melbourne streets in the pouring rain, he carries a hope like an Olympic flame, burning bright, never in vain. He's a runner in the eye of the storm, with every step he's rewriting the norm and the rhythm of the heartbeat's marathon pace. He's a doctor saving lives, a relentless race. Craig from Australia with the kindest eyes, chasing down the cure beneath the southern skies. Every finish line is a new life start. He's the healing force, the marathon heart.
Well done.
Are you converted?
I'm actually feeling a bit emotional listening to that. It's fantastic.
Hey,
thank you. At a more point, it's a half marathon, huge difference. But even so, you know, I'm happy to tell you I'm the wrong side of 60. And when I did the half marathon in Melbourne in October, I came in the top 100 for the over 60-year-old. So it wasn't bad. You know, the age of 60 to still be able to run 21K, I was very happy just to finish. And this was my daughter challenged me to do it and she got injured and didn't do it. So that's why we're doing a second one. So hopefully she'll make it to the start line on Saturday and we'll do this half marathon together. And Taylor Swift does not feature on my playlist that I've been listening to, Chris, but she does now.
So, listeners, if we have a different host next time, you know the run hasn't quite gone so well.
Thanks.
Will you be using a diclofenac foot gel, Craig, to reduce the inflammation of your sore thumbs?
I was just thinking about that. It's a big sore currently, so maybe that's what I need to do.
All right, listeners, tweet in your predicted time for Craig's half marathon. And the person who gets closest to the actual time will get one of Jackson's crackers sent out to you personally.
No, I want you to record that now and send me a sound file before Saturday, please, Chris. All right. It's been good chat to everyone, hopefully informative. Again, please, if you have suggestions, if you like it or don't like it or whatever, just send us some suggestions and any suggested papers will be welcomed. We want to make it relevant to as many people as possible. We know we have a very multidisciplinary audience and people see this as a way of trying to keep up with what's going on out there. So hopefully we're achieving those aims. Thank you to Rachel, who's patiently sitting on the sound desk, fixing our errors as we speak. Thanks, Rach, for all the organisation. Thanks, Kate. Thanks, Chris.
Kia ora.
Kia ora. We do shout outs and birthdays, so let us know. So I'll just do a quick shout out. This is to Dr. Catherine Hahn of Auckland. Thank you for letting me know that you're listening, and I hope you listen today.
Nice. Okay. See you next time, everybody.
Thank you for tuning in to the Oncology Journal Club podcast, proudly brought to you by the Oncology Podcast, part of the Oncology Network. For healthcare professionals seeking regular news updates and insightful discussions, we invite you to join our community at oncologynetwork.com.au.